Today I want to talk, I'm going to change the title of the talk a little bit to exploring meditation instructions as a gateway to transcendent awareness. That's the new title. And even if you're a beginning student, you'll be able to get something out of this talk. It's not over your head. Some of it will stretch you, and I hope all of us feel stretched along the way, because Dharma is a stretching event. It's not just a complacent event. It's not just a nodding of the head as you that you already know it. It stretches your intention. It stretches your wisdom, your capacity. It stretches you everywhere. So I always try to build a stretch in, regardless of your years of experience, into the talks I give. And today, I hope, will be no different. So, as a counterweight to division and deception, we enter the Dharma and we acknowledge that. It's sacred. It's spirit. You want to know where spirit is? It's everywhere. Why don't we see it? Because we want to be enclosed within our own egoic sense of self. And that keeps spirit out. That freezes our location in relationship to spirit. So it's important to understand where Dharma is going. So where is all this going? Well, the Dharma is a movement, irreversible movement towards the essential, our essential nature, our absolute non-reducible ground of being. That's where all this goes. And what is the ultimate practice to achieve this goal? That's the question. Well, the Buddha gave us a clear direction when he established the movement, the direction, the view that Dharma heads, which is that irreducible ground of being. He said, here's how you get to it. He said, very simply, cling to naught. Cling to naught. How do I do that? Well, first, let's explain what cling to naught means. It means in our modern vocabulary, we would say letting go or surrendering or releasing or letting be. These are all synonyms for cling to naught. And really, if you think about it, the opposite of letting go is building up. And through effort and goal, we have been on a path in our human lives of building ourselves up, of putting layer upon layer of conceptual thought and idea upon ourselves. And we do this and we call it knowledge, and I'm not in any way discouraging knowledge. It's just that it, in terms of Dharma, we move it in an opposite direction. Doesn't mean we lose or forget everything we've learned. We never forget that. We're just not attached with the knowledge base as being, as building ourselves up upon that knowledge base and promoting ourselves. So then you have to ask, so how does surrender or clinging to naught lead to this ultimate goal of moving towards the non-reducible ground of being? Because conceptualization is our mental constructs that we put upon ourselves, self-ideas about who we are and what we are. We just keep maintaining those and adding to them, as I just mentioned. So what we're doing is we're changing course now. Instead of promoting ourselves further with a new knowledge base and a new ability and potential to do this and that and all the productivity that we claim ourselves, this is a releasing our mental constructs. This is releasing the layer upon layer that we've already accumulated. So it's a releasing, it's a letting go. So how do you release and let go? You simply, again, you don't forget it. You don't try to say, I don't know that about me. I'm not going to add another idea about me. Rather, what you do is you just aren't attached to that accumulation that we already have. And so there gets to be this lightness of spirit because we're no longer identified with the knowledge that we've already accumulated. And not just knowledge, but our past and memories as well. We carry our memories around us to secure a positionality, to know where we are in life and to know our place in life. That's what memories allow us to do, as well as our knowledge base. And all of that provides a definite sense of individuation and separation and self-prominence, but it doesn't provide freedom. It doesn't let us go to the essential nature of being. It obstructs that. It layers that so that we don't have access to it. So this is where the Dharma goes. And regardless of where you start, and no matter how many years you've been practicing, we should keep this in mind because we can easily forget the direction the Dharma takes. If we forget the direction the Dharma takes, the sense of self, the egoic sense of self, will usurp that direction and guide it towards its own prominence, guaranteed. Okay, so now what I want to do is show how the meditation instructions, and this is a really interesting point. It came to me kind of out of the blue. I thought, well, you know, if you look at the meditation instructions in terms of the view and purpose, really, you could see the entire Dharma unfold within those instructions and my interpretation of those instructions along the way. Hopefully, as we mature in the Dharma, what we do as our practice, meditation practice, begins to reveal the possibilities where those instructions can take us. Now, let me just say that one of the beautiful components of Buddhism in particular, because that's the tradition I know, I don't really know the other religions of the day in the way I know Buddhism, is that it's a realized tradition. It's not just an intellectual tradition. Reading a book and knowing this or that gives you more knowledge about Buddhism, but doesn't let you realize it. This is an internal realization. We're changing the cells of our body. We are actually giving ourselves life within the seeing of what it is that the instructions are pointing. The seeing of that, as opposed to the intellectualization of that, is where Buddha points. And thank God, it's a practice that changes us. You know, you aren't going to be the same person, even from day one, after you have practiced and integrated views of Buddhism. Not from belief. It's not a belief religion. It's not a faith-based religion. It's a transformative religion. It's there for us to actually transform our consciousness in so that we see what is being said in truth, not in pretension or in falsehood. So now, the meditative instructions ultimately move, as I was mentioning, to the essential nature of life. Well, the essential nature of life, when we release all the constructions that have been built upon it, is really stillness. So the meditation instructions are attempting to make us more still, to make us quieter, to think less, basically. And you think, well, you know, your whole life has been about promoting your thinking. Well, and this is what we become through that promotion, what you are now, the struggles that we have, the divisions that we have, the angst that we have, that's what promoting thought does to us as individuals. So the question I would have is, let's just see what happens. Again, we're not asking you to lose anything, just not invest in it as being the sole purpose of life. We just release ourselves from the need to infuse every object that we see with thought, or ourselves with our particular history and memory. What does it look like when we come, as we start moving in the direction of greater quietude? I ask, why not try it? If I was asking you to cut off your arm, that would be a different strategy. But this is something every one of us can do. And if you don't like it, you can go back and be noisy again. Nothing's going to happen to you in the interim that prohibits you being the egoic sense of self that you already are if you want to return there. So this is an encouragement towards greater quietude. Now, the beauty about the practice, and something that I think is important, is that the instructions are really, there are three levels to them. First one, you know, the way we normally handle instructions is it's a kind of requirement to do the to do this practice. The instructions are the way to do it, the details and requirements for having to do it. And so we set out with the instructions as being, you know, okay, we can each have our own individual relationship to instructions. Mine was very, I wanted to get it right. And I kept going to the teacher and say, you know, when this happens, what am I supposed to do here? And I don't quite understand how this whole thing works. And you know, I wanted the details and I wanted to get it right. And that was where I was coming from. But in so doing, I became too strict in relationship to what I was doing. There was no room to move. There was no breath there. There was no newness. I was just holding myself to the letter of the law, you might say. So that's one way to practice instructions, and hopefully we don't stay too long within that tight, straight jacket of requirement and getting it right sort of trajectory. Because the next way you start doing it, you start, so these instructions actually help me. They actually do something for me. And so then we move from the requirement, the strict enforcement of keeping ourselves within the letter of the law. We evolve out of that into self-care. Self-care. This is how most people evolve through the instruction, not just me. And each part that I'm talking about now allows the ego to settle, you might say. If I can get the instructions right, then I can move to the next step. Well, getting the instructions right also has a downside, and that downside is it keeps us too strictly interpreted. And so it keeps us so narrowly focused that we feel boxed in. So then we think, okay, how can these instructions help me? You know, they're supposed to do something. It's not supposed to keep me feel boxed in. What? How do the instructions actually give me more space to move? And so we start, because we are living within the egoic frame of reference during much of our spiritual journey, the next level, the next movement forward is in terms of self-care. And we start seeing something beautiful happen when we move into not the letter of law, but the spirit of the law, the spirit of the instruction. As we start seeing that it's tender, it's making us tender, it's making us quieter, it's softening this mind in a way that the strict interpretations was actually working counter to. And this feels good to us. It feels pleasurable. It feels worthy. It feels like the direction I want to go as a person. Again, we're still within the confines of personhood, but don't worry about that. I often talk about it as self-thinning. We're thinning ourselves here. And let me just, as an onside, let me just say that awakening, I don't think of awakening as one event and settled. It's a continuum. It's really as this sense of who we are becomes less dense, less self-centered, less contracted. We thin ourselves in the heart, and these instructions begin to thin ourselves out. We begin to feel lighter. We have less reactivity. We're less angry. We may even have less self-doubt, though that may take a long time. But there's generally more gentleness and kindness. We start seeing ourselves in relationship to the world and others. And suddenly others become the more pervasive view than self-centeredness. And that's all part of the thinning process of awakening. So we haven't made the switch to no self and non-self and emptiness and all that other thing, but we're on our way to thinning towards that. And once you thin something, eventually light gets through. And when light gets through, those are moments of awakening, awakened moments. So the continuum is what I stress, not those awakened moments. The awakened moments certainly have their place, but they're not the sole place for this. And so if you don't feel that you are any closer to the emptiness of self, let me change that word, because emptiness has such a negative connotation. I don't like the word emptiness. What do you get? You should get something out of this. If you just get emptiness, there's nothing. There's not. Or people who say the void. I'm not going. Why do I want to go to the void? I mean, it should be appealing. It should be heart draw. It should draw our heart out. Well, it so happens that if you redefine the word emptiness into incomprehensible, that's really what it means, or inconceivable. So that thoughts, it can't be known through thought, through verbalization, through ideas. It's what's on the other side of those verbalizations and ideas. That is what is inconceivable and incomprehensible. So, and here's a word that I think we can all get behind, and that's wonder. W-O-N-D-E-R, wonder. Really, this process, this moving towards our absolute non-reducible ground of being, is movement into wonder. Not I wonder, not I like wonder, but wonder itself. The sense of being is wondrous, is wonder in its origin, in its isness, it's wonder. Why else would we be so drawn towards mysteries, the mystery of things? Not what we know. What we know, we already know. That's not so, for me, it's not, okay, you want to be creative in what you know and move to the next step, what you don't know upon what you know. You want to take what you know and move it to the next step of being creative, so you don't know where this is going. That's what where wonder is. Wonder takes what we are already. It doesn't try to dismiss it or negate it. It takes it and it starts saying, okay, this is what I am. Let me just release the need to be the heavy, dense form that I think myself to be. And in that simple willingness to release our substantial history, you start feeling wondrous. You start being wondrous. Start entering wonder. And that's where the instructions are meant to take us. They're meant to point towards something undefinable. You see? Undefinable. And most people do it, as I was mentioning, in phases. They don't just, because when you are in a state of wonder, that, I mean, the feeling of it itself is, it's not fearful, it's wondrous. But to the egoic sense of self, moving to areas that we don't know can be confusing and fearful, anxiety provoking. Anytime we stretch ourselves beyond our own boundaries, beyond what we know, our own limitation, we feel, we can feel a little bit of uncertainty and confusion. And if that scares us enough, we'll come back into our boundaries. That's why the sense of egoic prominence keeps pulling us from wonder. It keeps pulling us back from moving counter to our boundaries. But the instructions, bless their hearts, take us the opposite direction. I mean, we can use it to stay firmly invested in where we are, which is the way I was doing it early on, taking it just to the letter of the law. But as it starts bringing in different aspects of ourselves, so we start transforming under it by doing the instructions, you start finding yourself changing in accordance to the true meaning and words of where the instructions are pointing. And it's actually beautiful to see. And some people say, I don't understand selflessness at all, but oh, I have such a tender heart for the homeless, or I care about myself that I never did, and I find I'm more kinder. Well, because you haven't had a rip in the fabric of your awakening doesn't mean that you haven't been awakening this whole time. The sense of self is very tenacious. It's one of the last things that the sense of perceiving ourselves as wondrous is one of the last terrains that the sense of self will allow. The sense of self binds us. It only takes one word to bind us bind us within its conceptual frame of reference. It takes one word, one sentence, and then the whole, like a cereal lighting on a Christmas tree, you find that wrong, that bulb that's burned out, and the whole light, all the lights come back on. And as soon as we establish even a single image or idea as being true, meaning we're attached to it, then all of the thoughts, memories, and come flashing back on full breath. So that's the reason that the sense of self seems so difficult to penetrate. It's because we haven't given up everything, but we're feeling the effects of thinning as we're moving forward. And it's beautiful. We all should, just from time to time, just reflect upon our lives and the way we're moving, as opposed to the way the outside world seems to be becoming more disconnected and more abrasive and more divided. And your heart, even as you listen to this, is that the way you want to be? And I promise you that almost everyone, if not every one of you, say, no, I don't want to be that way. I want to be more connected. I want to thin myself. So, because we may not have reached living in wonder, the inconceivable, the incomprehensible sense of where emptiness will ultimately land us, doesn't mean that we aren't well on our way towards that end. And so just to look at how the instructions start moving us in that direction, the first thing, it starts collecting this. It allows us to feel collected. And I hope today, it's only a day long, and so I'm your moment-to-moment individuated, focused attention and concentration isn't going to be the same as if you did a longer retreat. But you can be collected. You can collect yourself. You can know that you're sitting right now or standing or whatever posture you're in. You can just feel that sense of presence that allows you to have a very different orientation to your life and the life that seems to be outside. So just allow yourself to slow down and collect. And that's what the instructions do. The instructions say, sit down. You know, as a monk, every time we ate or toileted, we have to sit down. There was no standing up. And you go, God, why are they doing this? Because when you're sitting down, you're collected, much more so than when you're moving around. When you're moving around, oftentimes the movement indicates mind movement as well. And so you're just moving in accordance to how the mind is telling you to move. But when you're sitting down, there's at least we're not moving. We're collecting ourselves, and we have the opportunity to become quieter within that sense of collectedness and slowing down. So the direction of the instructions from day one, just sit here. We're going to sit, have that intention. Okay. So here's some ways for you to get a sense of whether the instructions are working for you or not. Are you feeling more defended or more open? Do you hold yourself, you know, in a defensive posture, or are you more open to listening, to feedback, etc.? Is there less denial? For God's sake, I can't believe the depth. You know, I knew this as a hospice worker, how denial, often in terms of somebody's, whether they're going to die or not, how much energy we spend in denying the truth. And really what the Dharma is meant to open us up to the truth. That's really all it does. It doesn't establish new truths. It just shows us the truths we've been hiding from. And our willingness to see those truths is all that's really necessary for the whole of the Dharma to open. So are we moving towards greater self-wonder or more self-certainty? You know, is this, it's not, you know, when I say that, it's like an either or, but it's not an either or. Sometimes you're going to find yourself wanting to be self-certain. You're going to want to know who you are in this particular situation. And that's fine. And you're going to want a self-care. You want your heart to open. You want certain attributes and certain qualities in you, and you have a different sense of self in relationship to yourself when you have those qualities. Though it's all fine. As I said, that's the way. But you shouldn't forget that the ultimate direction is towards wonder, towards mystery, towards the incomprehensible. So this is fine. This is most, if not all, people move through self-certainty, but it's not the final resting place. And here's one that I think is an important one, is are we dwelling more in what we have in common or in our differences? And this is interesting. Not too many years ago, a newspaper reporter came and did an article. I was teaching at Sims at the time, and they said, "Well, how is around diversity?" The question was around diversity. And I said, "How does the Dharma help in diversity?" And I says, "Well, it makes differences less important." And I don't know how people misunderstood that, but I got a lot of backlash from it. But it does. It makes individual differences less important, so that you don't see from the appearance level of sight. You see, because what we share, the spirit, the common spirit we all share, the common presence we all have, it's like an encyclopedia compared to a single dot at the end of a sentence. It's so magnanimous what we share in common that the individual differences, you want to make sure that individual differences don't bring you down into comparison and prejudice within that difference. But when you start seeing from a point of view of connectedness, interconnectedness, it doesn't matter anymore what the color of a person's skin is or how bright they are or how tall they are or their gender or anything about them, because that the sense of spirit, of presence, isn't defined by any of that. And that's where we begin to live more and more, in the wonder of being alive, not in the particularities of what aliveness looks like. So, we don't want to be too literal in our instructions. We want the instructions to pave a path forward towards wonderment. And self-care usually is one of the phases that we go through in relationship towards our journey to wonderment. And how then do the instructions change that perception? And also, how do the instructions give us a wise view and path forward? That's what we're discussing here today. So refreshing the instructions from time to time makes sense. If you just get habituated by what they mean, and this is true of all Dharma, you know, when you sit down and meditate, if you just do the same thing every single time and you're just watching a clock and say, well, okay, it's time to get up now, really nothing seems to be happening because nothing is happening. We're just keeping ourselves kind of locked into a particular frame of reference as to what the meditation is, what I'm supposed to be doing in the meditation. And that's not really what this whole thing is about. Now, see if you can hear the relative self-care in the instruction. And then see if you can hear the absolute essence of being in the instruction as well. Usually, if you listen to what the instructions say, you'll hear them through the funnel, through the concepts of how you hold yourself to be. But you can listen quieter beyond yourself, and you can see where they're ultimately leading. And that's what I want to really show today, is the importance of keeping this thing moving and not freezing our location in any particular time. So the first thing that we hear when we're in a meditation retreat, or we're getting our beginning meditation instructions, sounds like something that a third grade teacher would tell us to do when we were being naughty. Sit down, sit still, be quiet, don't move. It sounds like a punishment. Sounds like, oh my God, I did something wrong. Okay. But that not in quite the tone that I mentioned there, that I stated it, but sit down. Okay, sit down. I just mentioned how sitting down establishes a collectedness for most of us that most of us can't or lose when we're in motion, which is an interesting, I'll get to that in a moment, but why in motion do we lose ourselves more than when we sit down? That's a question that's part of the instructions to observe and to understand as well. But first, let's just sit down. Okay, collect myself. And you can just feel when you're not in movement, if you're truly not in movement, you can really, you know, you can feel the pleasure of settling in. But then it says, sit still. Now, why would I want to do that? It's because we're not interested in the mind and body movement. We're not interested in perpetuating our images and extending our images. If you ever look at activity, whatever you're doing in the moment, rarely has invited your attention within that activity. Usually what we're doing is thinking about the next thing we're going to do. Either after we get done with this thing or in the midst of it, we're thinking about not this and the activity in itself in a settled kind of way, but what our day is going to look like as it unfolds moment, movement after movement after movement. And that obviously, that thought process, that one thought after another thought after another thought, creates a prism through which thinking holds us within ourselves and within our lives. It's a prism. And what the meditation instructions are attempting to do in this moment, sit still. 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 Don't let the mind, don't move along with the mind. I was going to say, the mind's going to continue to move whether you're sitting still or not. But you can decide your awareness, whether your awareness is going to get caught up in that movement or whether it's going to hold that movement and let the movement pass. We have the ability, the option to be able to determine that. And so sitting down, sitting still, okay, and then being quiet. Be quiet. Again, that's suggesting that there's a quiet in us. It's not the be quiet shaking of your teacher, third grade teacher. It's the invitation to see if quiet pre-exists us, pre-exists the thinking. The thinking has to come out of somewhere, has to at one point have been quiet, and then noise. Noise comes out of quiet. Let me find the origin. You see, when we're looking at the essence of being, we're not so interested in the products that are coming out of each layer upon layer of concepts. We're looking at what is the essence, what was there, what allowed it to arise, from what did it arise, from what did it arise. And you'll find that all noise arises out of quiet. Noise doesn't sustain itself, and therefore it falls back into quiet. When we miss that, we're just waiting for the next thought stream to propel us forward. We're missing the quiet. And the meditation instruction is supposed to start allowing a relationship with quiet. And that's where it's taking us. Remember in the early part of this talk, I was talking about accessing wonder can only be done through quiet and stillness. That's what the definition of wonder is, really. That is wonder, quiet and stillness. So the meditation instruction should be taking us into a quieter. But if we're going to bring a lot of psychological issues into our meditation, like I can't do this right, and oh, this is tedious and I'm bored, all we're doing is covering that quiet with layer upon layer of reactivity. And we're also being asked to sit still through all of that. So we're asked to not get up and say, I'm bored, I'm going to find something more entertaining. We're asked to sit still through all of this boredom. And that's what it's pointing to. And we think, oh God, okay, I'll just hold myself in place. I'll wait it through. I'll wait it through. And oh God, how many more minutes do I have? Jesus. See, that's not the point of this thing. It wants to get us down into the basic level of being, where quiet is, where stillness is. You see, and that's what it's calling us to do. It's not a relative quiet, it's an absolute quiet. Just this, the quiet that holds all noise. Not the relative quiet between moments when I'm not thinking quite as much. It's beautiful, really. And then it says, don't move. Now here, this is an important point, and I don't think people really understand. When you do sit down, you don't want to just scratch, and you know, you don't want to just, oh, I'm feeling a little, you know, just sit. just for that period of time, don't move. Why is it that it's asking us not to move? Because movement, unconscious movement mostly, towards pleasurable relief of discomfort and discomfort and the difficult is what we do unconsciously. So we constantly stay in motion unconsciously to little irritations, itches, little painful episodes. And this is saying, all right, if you're stressing and if you're anxious, then, and if you think something, you're hurting yourself, then do move. But otherwise, just don't move. You're countering the conditioning of yourself, of what holds yourself together. You, the sense of us, is held together through conditioning, mostly unconscious conditioning. And so not to move allows us to get a hold of those little irritating ways that we move all day long that we're not even aware of, that hold ourselves together. It's the glue that establishes us as individuated people. And this is countering that. It's moving us much more deeply into the profound, unconditioned. Wonder is unconditioned. We're looking at what life is before it was conditioned. That's what the essence of being is, before conditions. And so it's encouraging us in all of these different ways, sitting down, sitting still, being quiet, relaxing, which I'll get to in just a second. And don't move. Those are ways to encourage us towards unconditioned, to the unconditioned. This is where this is pointing. And it's also, after we have sat down, sat still, we're quiet, we're not moving. It then says, relax, relax. I'm trying not to move. It seems impossible to add this final instruction onto what we've just been speaking about. Seems contradictory. But what we have to realize is that the reason it seems contradictory to be quiet and sit still is because of our tendency to follow our conditioning rather than to relax. When you relax, you're not following the conditioning. You're releasing the conditioning. And when you release conditioning, you're settling into greater quietude. You're more collected. You're quieter and stiller, and we're not moving. And that relaxation isn't counter to those instructions. It's moving in accordance to those instructions. So it's not just a physical relaxation, it's psychic relaxation. We're such a bundle of tension. That's another way to describe what a human being is in his or her essence, is this bundle of tension and struggle. Everything seems to be a struggle because it's us and the rest of the world. You know, your life, our lives, are usually moving occasionally in accordance with the rest of the world and much of the time against the rest of the world, where we have arguments about everything, the weather, the neighbors, the kind of food we're eating, everything. Every condition doesn't fit our ideal. And when it doesn't fit our ideal, which is almost all the time, relaxation is not there. Anxiety and tension is what is left. This is crazy. You know, this is crazy. And we can use these simple instructions and to encouraging us into deeper and deeper, more profound periods of true contentment. Relaxation is contentment. So do we lose our orientation when we relax and are quiet and don't move? Do we lose our sense of propriety, what we need to do. No, none of that. We do it within the relaxed response. We do it within the stillness. We still know what we have to do. We eat when we are hungry. We mow the lawn when it's relevant. We move from here to there in a relaxed way. Because the awareness, as we're moving down, we're sitting down, sitting still, being quiet, not moving, and relaxing. Guess what's arising? Awareness is rising out of that. Because those not sitting down, not being still, not being quiet and moving and being anxious is the lack of awareness. It's the blockage of awareness. That thwarts awareness. That prohibits awareness. So as we take these instructions to heart, and we have many, many more. This isn't the final talk. I'm giving another talk this afternoon, but I'll end this one soon here. You find something springs up. Something comes out of us that was naturally there. When I say this is, you know, we're looking at what is the essence of our being. Well, it can't be artificial. It can't be something that you're imposing or that you're conditioning onto yourself. It has to be what's there when all the conditioning is gone, when all the anxiety is gone, when there is ease of well-being. What's left, you see, isn't conditioned. And awareness is what's left. So, of course, as I start sitting down and behaving in accordance, moving in accordance to the instruction, what's happening is that awareness is rising up, is showing itself. It's always been there. It's because it's fundamental. It's fundamental. It's showing itself. It doesn't have to be practiced. We just have to release ourselves from the tension that keep it from being visible. Release ourselves from the tension that keeps it from being available, livable, existent. That's the point. Being quiet is the key to inward awareness. It's the noise that we create. See, the tension all has thought back. Oh, God, what's going on? My back. And it has history. I've had this back problem. It has all of that. Well, how can what is essential show itself when we're lost in the noise of the non-essential? You see, this is crazy. It's so obvious because it's there when noise isn't. And in that way, we truly know that we're moving in relationship to the mystery of life, to the wonder of life, to the inexplicable. That's what, I mean, I hope those words invite a heart connection to you as they do to me, because they're so alluring. And even though the ego has its fear about what those words will mean to it, that fear is nothing in comparison to the fulfillment that entering the wonderment offers. Okay. Okay. All right.